Elizabeth, by the grace of God, Queen of England, do give and grant to our trustee and well-beloved servant, Sir Humphrey Gilbert of Compton, and to his heirs and assigns for ever, free liberty and license from time to time, and at all times for ever hereafter, to discover such remote, heathen and barbarous lands, countries and territories not actually possessed of any Christian prince or people, and the same to have, hold, occupy, and enjoy to him, his heirs, and assigns for ever.
That's Queen Elizabeth I in 1578, arbitrarily granting Sir Humphrey Gilbert the right to own any land he found in North America, even though it wasn't really hers to give away. So how much of our wealth and income today is the result of unjust transactions like this one? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research, a series of conversations with the world's leading economists. My name is Tim Phillips. Powerful nations grew rich and stayed rich using the wealth that their leaders extracted from their colonies, peasants and workers. But if these transactions were unjust at the time, does that injustice fade or does it persist? Now, you might assume this question is best left to philosophers, but at least one CEPR fellow thinks that economics can help us decide. And recently, I went to see him in his office at Imperial College London to ask him how. David Miles, welcome to Vox Talks.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
Now, this is based on your recent paper, which is called The Half-Life of Economic Injustice. Many people object even to the idea that you can model injustice using equations. So what would you say to them?
What I'm trying to do in this paper is ask a question about the extent to which ownership of assets, productive assets, machines, buildings that came about unjustly in the past might be having an effect on incomes and wealth today. And that depends on how those assets in the past were used. Did people use the income that they generated and saved it and accumulated wealth and passed that on to future generations so that the impact of those unjustly owned assets in the past is still with us? Or did those assets simply depreciate? They were consumed by the people that stole them, and their impact today on income and wealth is negligible. So things like what was the savings rate out of income generated by those assets is crucial in thinking about whether there's a long-lasting impact on the economy today. And economic growth theory really is a very useful tool, I think, for thinking about how actions in the past affect the future and are influenced by technological progress and also savings rates. So it seems to me that this economic question, which is focusing on a particular aspect of injustice, is one that is indeed amenable to mathematical modeling using the kind of models that we frequently use in economics, sort of growth economics.
As you point out in a paper, to do this successfully, you're going to need two different things. And the first is that you need a theory of justice to work out who has a right to those assets in the first place. And then you need some kind of framework to estimate how much wealth and income is unjust at any time. So for the first part, you've used the ideas of a philosopher called Robert Nozick. For the people who haven't encountered him before, can you explain why you picked him?
Yes. Nozick is an American philosopher who wrote what became, I think, a very influential book called Anarchy, State and Utopia in 1974. The book was published in 74. It was in many ways a reaction to what is to economists probably a more well-known book, John Rawls's Theory of Justice, which came out in 1971. And Nozick's idea, which I think is a powerful one, is that how some distribution of resources, income and wealth came about historically is central to any judgment we might make about it as to whether it is just or not. And Nozick is writing in many ways as a critic of Rawls. Rawls, like many economic views on justice in terms of distribution of wealth and income, Rawls's idea really is not historical, it's ahistoric. It focuses very much on what is the distribution of income and wealth. And I think that's a view that has influenced many economists who tend to look at a distribution of income and wealth and make judgments about whether it's fair or just without asking how it came about. But I think many people, or most people, would say that how income and wealth came to be owned by the people that have it today, how it happened historically, is very relevant to whether it is fair or unfair. Nozick's book, Anarchy, State and Utopia, for people who haven't read it, I think it is a wonderfully crafted argument. And as an aside, Nozick, who was a philosopher and spent most of his life in the philosophy department at Harvard, was very interested in economics, although he had no formal training in economics. I mean, if one reads the book, one can see economic arguments cropping up many times.
But this idea of Nozick's is precisely why many economists and some philosophers object to his reasoning. He doesn't have any opinion about the distribution of assets. So isn't this a very narrow frame of reference to start with?
Well, I don't think it's quite fair to say he has no view on it. I think he has a particular view, which is that if assets have been fairly acquired in the past and they are willingly passed on by the people that acquired them in the past to, for example, their offspring, or simply gifted to other people, if that is willingly done, then the chain of justice in some sense continues. The flip side of it is, I think, also a very intuitive notion, which is that if I acquire some asset unjustly, I steal it, and I pass it then on to somebody else, I willingly give it then to somebody else, that injustice has not been rectified. And therefore, the ownership of the person to whom I give the stolen goods is itself unjust. And that's really the idea that I draw upon in this paper.
Looking at your modelling, many undergrad economists would recognise a large part of this paper because you're using a Solow growth model. Why did you pick that?
I mean, you're right. There's nothing terribly sophisticated in the model of the evolution of the economy and its growth over time. There's nothing particularly sophisticated in that side of this paper. And I think this is a case of using, in some ways, the simplest model that does the job. And the Solow growth model, very familiar, as you say, to most undergraduates, has the characteristics that are essential to an assessment of how ownership of assets in the past affects the economy into the future. And in the Solow model, of course, it's the savings rate that's critical, the savings rate out of capital assets, which generates the capital stock for the future, which is used to produce incomes from which future generations will themselves save and pass on a stock of assets into the next generation. Now, some people would say, of course, the Solow model is terribly simple and it was developed 50-odd years ago. Aren't there more sophisticated models? Well, there may be. I try in the paper to stress that actually what you might call the microeconomic underpinnings of that model are reasonably well-founded in, for example, overlapping generations models. And an overlapping generations model, which you could see as the underpinning of this Solow thing, is absolutely the right way to think about the evolution of ownership of assets and whether they're just and unjust over time. I mean, that's a natural feature of an overlapping generations model.
The first part of the paper looks at wealth that has been expropriated from foreigners, rather like Sir Humphrey Gilbert would have done to any people he found in North America. How do you model that? What does it tell us?
In some ways, this is one of the simplest cases to try and work out, because imagine that one country steals a load of assets from another. The Vikings arrive in northern England and take a load of cattle and just take it off of them and then use it. So we can work out, using a Solow time model, what the level of income and wages in a country that stole some capital from another country would be, both with and without some stock of assets that were stolen at some point in the past. I mean, essentially, one is taking a Solow growth model and saying, imagine the start point in 1500 looks like this. How does the economy then evolve over the next several hundred years? And then taking a different start point and say, what would have happened if that stock of assets that they stole from the neighboring country was not there? And you could then ask the question, supposing you move on 300 years, and now we're in 1800, what would the level of income and wealth have been with and without the assets that were stolen? And the difference between the two is a measure of how long-lasting the effect of that crime in the past, when assets were unjustly stolen, how much impact is that having 300 years later? That's the calculation. Relatively straightforward, nothing terribly clever about it, but I think it reveals what sort of forces will make injustice either last a long time or not a very long time. the depreciation of capital, the savings rates, the growth in the population, what happens to technical progress.
You calibrate this with some reasonable statistics that represent the sort of economy that we've lived in historically. What comes out of it?
I think what comes out of it is that if we stick with the simple Solow model, labour is combined with capital to produce output, then using standard assumptions about depreciation of physical assets and the growth of economies through productivity and labour force growing, then so long as that's how the economy remains, then the impact of one country having stolen a lot of assets, say, 100 years ago, actually declines relatively quickly. So in the simple case where we've stolen some assets from another country, one tends to find that the impact of that after 60, 70 years, it looks to be relatively limited, quite small. The half-life in the title of my paper refers to how long does it take for the impact on income and wealth just after some assets have been stolen to fall to half its initial value. So, for example, if 50% of the wealth of a country had been stolen from some other country, how many years do you have to wait until only 25% of its wealth directly and indirectly was influenced by those stolen assets? And in the standard Solow type model, when you steal assets from overseas, that half-life is rarely more than 20 or 30 years. And what that means is that after, say, 90 years, the impact of what may initially have been a very large proportion of assets being stolen has shrunk to really quite small levels.
But of course, David, you're really only telling half the story, maybe even less than half the story there, because you're looking at the injustice from the point of view of the people who did the taking. Can the model measure the impact on the wealth of the communities or the countries who had the things taken from them?
You're right that the focus of this paper is really on the question, how much richer are we than we should be if we strip out the effects of unjustly acquiring assets in the past? So in a sense, it's asking the question from the point of view of the rich countries who may have had a colonial past or for other reasons acquired assets unjustly. You're right to ask that question because there is potentially a great difference depending on from which side you're viewing it. Let me give you an example. If you take Belgium, Belgium in the late 19th century looted on a staggeringly vast scale assets from what was then the Congo. I suspect that if you ask the question, how much richer is a typical Belgian person today as a result of what King Leopold III did at the end of the 19th century, the answer probably is not a great deal. If you ask the question, why is the Democratic Republic of Congo as poor as it still is, that may well be significantly because of events that took place at the end of the 19th century, which then affected its whole political institutional structure and may well have held it back. So I'm in this paper, at least, focusing on the question from the point of view of the expropriator of assets rather than the expropriated.
Can we change this model to make the expropriated the focus?
I think it would involve a bit of tweaking to the most appropriate model. It seems to be a very good question to ask. It's one on which there is a significant economics literature of a particular sort, which focuses on the political institutions that were left behind when imperial powers withdrew, which is one aspect of the issue, not perhaps the one that I'm focusing on so much in this paper.
Now, let's have a look at when one group takes from another, but they're in the same country. How does that change what you're doing here?
It changes it in the following sense. If one country steals some productive assets from another country and then brings them back to the home country and uses them, that will increase both profits generated from capital, but it'll also mean that wages are somewhat higher than they otherwise would have been. And using the Nozick's principle, that would mean that both capital income and labour income, to some extent, reflect injustice. And that's taken account of in the first set of calculations in the paper, which look at stealing assets from overseas. Supposing we flip it around, though, and we think now about assets stolen by one group within an economy from another group within the same economy. So that does not change the aggregate amount of capital. And in a typical neoclassical model with a production function, it means that the level of wages will be no different. And in fact, that's plausible in a sense. If I'm working on the the land of one baron and another baron comes along and just steals the land and I carry on working on that land, earning whatever pittance I'm paid in 1400. It hasn't affected my wages and there's no sense in which my labour income is unjust simply because the land was taken from one owner to another owner and I never saw any of it. So in this second set of calculations, which I think are in many ways the more relevant ones given the history of many countries where assets are stolen from one group within the country by another, we would no longer want to say that wage income earned from that part of capital that's been unjustly stolen by one group from another is itself unjust. And that makes a significant difference to the calculations. It also makes relevant the relative savings rates out of labour and capital. And it turns out that that makes a very big difference to the question as to how long injustice lasts. In fact, there's one result which wasn't obvious to me until I sort of worked through the algebra, which is that if the savings rate out of labour income is very low, the rate at which injustice fades itself becomes very low. Or to put it another way, the half-life of injustice becomes much longer if the savings rate out of labour income is very low.
And of course, that's quite a reasonable conclusion to reach, isn't it? That poor people don't save very much and rich people save a lot.
I think historically, it's certainly true until we get into the modern era that those people that simply had their own labour income were hardly in a position to save anything. I mean, they were doing well just to feed and house themselves and stay warm in the winter. And therefore, the savings rate out of labour income probably was very low historically until quite recently. And therefore, the half-life of injustice, according to the calculations in my paper, would have been very long. I think things do change as we move through the 20th century. In particular, we have the emergence for the first time of formal pension arrangements for many people. We have labour incomes rising much more strongly than they had historically, and savings out of labour income become a more significant factor in the 20th century.
Finally, you're looking at the contribution of human capital to growth and how this changes things. Well, how does it change things?
It changes things in the following way. Superficially, you might think that since we all, in some sense, own our own physical labour power, any income that we earn from the application of our labour power is justly owned by ourselves. With what you might call innate labour power, there's a very strong case for that. But of course, a lot of the incomes people earn are a reflection of their human capital, the education that they've had. And that education can be quite expensive. And it may well be that to some extent, the accumulation of human capital through education was partly at least funded by using income that historically may itself have been acquired unjustly. So the financing of education to some extent from income, which itself reflected unjustly acquired wealth, that's a mechanism for injustice lasting longer than it otherwise would have. And I don't think it's too fanciful to think that this is of some significance. Historically, the barons of the 13th, 14th, and 15th century, the robber barons of the 19th century, the oligarchs of today, their children, on average, have enjoyed much better education than the population in general. And to some extent, that persists right through to today. And so I think this is a factor that certainly affects the extent to which injustice continues into the future. And the calculations in the paper suggest that it can be, in some circumstances, of real significance.
Now, when most people think of unjust historical economic transactions, you straight away think about slavery. You haven't dealt with slavery in this paper. Why not?
Well, you're right. It isn't explicitly a focus of the paper. I think there's something that the paper adds to it, which is that to the significant extent, that slavery generated income and wealth for those that profited from it, that what you might call tangible wealth is very much part of the story, because one would want to count that tangible wealth clearly as unjustly acquired, and the calculations of the paper are then as relevant to that as assets stolen when one country invades another and takes away its capital stock. One thing I should say, however, which is this, even if it was the case that the longer-term economic impacts of some injustice in the acquisition of assets, maybe partly as a side effect of an appalling injustice like slavery, even if it were the case that the lasting economic impact of that may become relatively low after a few hundred years, that absolutely doesn't mean that the act itself in the past was any less unjust.
You also deal with aggregates here, and your argument is that, for example, income can be 20% unjust, say. But if that income means that I can do something, I can buy something, or I can start a business, and I wouldn't have been able to do it without that extra 20%, how can what I'm doing just be 20% unjust? It must be 100% unjust.
Well, you're right that if you dig beneath the aggregate estimates of what proportion of the capital stock is unjust, what proportion of income is unjust, of course, there will be a distribution amongst people. Let's say we calculated that 20% of incomes are a reflection of past injustices that are affecting incomes today. We could think of many different ways in which that overall 20% of income happens. It could be that 20% of the population have 100% of their income reflecting the ill-gotten actions of the past. Or it could be that all of us are, to some extent, 20% of what we've got reflects some nasty things that were done 150 years ago, but that 80% of what we did is kind of washed clean. So this paper doesn't try and delve beneath the aggregates. It would simply tell you 20% of aggregate income has a murky past and 80% is okay, and without asking too much about how that's distributed.
This is your first pass at this model. Are you going to be developing it, David?
Well, I'd be interested to see what people's reaction is. I think there's something in it, but I would, wouldn't I? Some people think it's kind of interesting idea and there's something in it. Some people, frankly, don't like the message that maybe injustices of 100, 150 years ago have shrunk in significance today. But I think one needs to be open-minded about that, and I'll be keen to hear more people's thoughts on it as perhaps more people take a look at it.
David, thank you.
Thank you very much.
I would really recommend you getting hold of this paper. It's not long, but if you're like me, you'll be arguing about it for weeks. It's called The Half-Life of Economic Injustice, and it's CEPR Discussion Paper 13342. David Miles has also contributed a blog post to VoxEU called What is the Half-Life of Economic Injustice?, which explains the method and has some of the results from the paper. Thanks for listening. We have new episodes every Friday, so if your New Year's resolution was to listen to more thought-provoking ideas in 2019, subscribe to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, or whatever your favourite platform is. You'll find us there. And you can always dip into our back catalogue at voxeu.org/vox-talks.